Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, Dan Proft.
Welcome to another edition of Illinois Rising. I'm Dan Proft, morning drive host on AM 560, Chicago's Morning Answer, with Amy Jacobson, 5 to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday. Joining me on this edition is Michael Lucci. He's Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. And, there was an election on Tuesday, November 8th, and here in Illinois, mixed results, but progress in the General Assembly. Illinois Comptroller Leslie Munger. She was defeated by Chicago City Clerk Susana Mendoza. And Munger had been a real partner with Governor Rauner in the turnaround agenda, trying to manage state finances with less money than obligations, like to the tune of tens of billions, less money than obligations. We're one of two states that lost a Republican incumbent senator, Mark Kirk, the only other state, New Hampshire, with Kelly Ayotte. But at the General Assembly, and we lost a congressman in Bob Dold out in the North Shore, we being a Republican because I are one, but Bob Dold lost, so the Republican contingent of the Illinois congressional delegation shrunk by one. But in the Illinois General Assembly, Governor Rauner made some progress. Net four pickups in the Illinois House, which gets Republicans out of the supermajority in the House, and a net two pickups in the Illinois State Senate, which doesn't get them out of the supermajority, but a superminority, excuse me, but starts to move towards that minority position. You need to get to 25. They've got 22. Mike Lucci, what are we to make of the pickups at the legislative level in Illinois and what that may portend for the final 2 years of Governor Rauner's first term?
Well, on the pure policy side, the good thing about this is that there are some really bad policy ideas that are now just off the table because there are issues that the governor would veto, such as just automatically giving more power to the state government unions. There are issues such as the progressive tax, which would require a supermajority, that are now going to be off the table for the next legislative session.
How does it impact the pending contract impasse between the governor and AFSCME, the state's largest public sector union?
Well, the election of Susana Mendoza could have some effect there because she's going to be in charge of paying state workers or not paying state workers. The impasse with AFSCME, I mean, they're not going to be able to shove through legislation that had been attempted several times, which would have given AFSCME more power in the negotiations with the governor. And the option to go to an arbitrator if they didn't like the final deal that the governor offered them. So those legislative proposals aren't going to be able to get through. And so AFSCME's position against the governor is certainly slightly weakened here.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Greg Bishop. He is a reporter with the Illinois News Network. He's also the host of his own radio show, Bishop on Air, on WMAY in Springfield, and he covers the State House and state politics and state policy. Greg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. Good day, guys.
So what's your assessment? You heard Michael Lucci. Is it your assessment in terms of the slight change in the balance of power in the General Assembly with the plus four in the House and the plus two in the Senate, and other than not being able to override gubernatorial vetoes on some issues where Republicans are unified because of the Republicans getting out of the super minority in the House. What else do you see in terms of political or policy impacts from the election results?
Yeah, all it took was one seat flipping for the Republicans to eat away at that super majority. And that super majority is what's necessary for Democrats to override the governor. However, as significant as that is, from going to a super majority to just a simple majority, you've got Democrats trying to downplay that, saying simply that they never had a true working super majority. But that again, downplays the significance of a presidential election year, Republicans getting gains, even if it is just one house in the one seat in the House. That's quite significant, and I think it shows that Democrats are not going to be able to wield as much power as they've had in the past.
What does that mean? So one of the big issues, Governor Rauner's first two years, is the impasse on a state budget. Can't get a constitutionally balanced state budget passed because the Democrats don't want to pass one. Does that change? Did the election results change that at all? Or are we going to, do you think, continue for the next 2 years with stopgap budgets like we've had for the past 6 months?
Realistically, I think what we're going to see is continued loggerheads because after the polls closed Tuesday, people seem to have an eye on the 2018 election for state house, but also for governor and other constitutional offices. So that seems to be the mentality going forward now. It's, you know, don't give in and continue the fight until 2018 when we see everything starting to pick up for statewide office. But realistically, I think it's going to be very problematic for Democrats in the optics game if they continue to block any kind of reform, even if it's just one simple reform that business is behind, like workers' compensation, not lowering it to the lowest in the country, but bringing it in line with the average cost instead of being the seventh most expensive or whatever the latest statistic is. I think that that's going to be very damaging for Democrats if they refuse to go along just because they're looking at the 2018 election.
Greg, what do you think in Illinois, where Donald Trump lost significantly, what do you think of the alternative strategies where Democrats tied Republicans as much as they could to Trump, whereas Republicans tied Democrats as much as they could to Madigan? And in that calculus, Madigan lost 4 seats. What do you think that says about his popularity in the state? And, you know, the majority that he's trying to keep, how wise would they be to hitch their star to Speaker Madigan going forward?
Yeah, it's fascinating because leading up to the election, Speaker Madigan's spokesman, Steve Brown, regularly, despite whatever question was thrown at him in the political arena, it was trying to associate Republicans to Trump. It may have been damaging in northern Illinois, but if you look at the numbers in southern Illinois, in the more rural areas, a lot of that was for Donald Trump. So it may have backfired to a degree in the southern part of the state. So, you know, speaking out of both sides of their mouth, trying to say, well, it's good to link Trump to these Republicans in northern Illinois. It was a bad idea to do it in southern Illinois. But I think the reality is people are starting to realize that Speaker Madigan has been in power for, you know, 3 decades. That's most of my life. And I think people have a problem with that. And even though they're not able to vote for him, they see that if they get more Republicans in the House, they'll be able to probably diminish the power of Democrats and of Speaker Michael Madigan.
What about the rank and file members of the respective caucuses in both chambers? Did the results, do you hear anything from the Capitol that the results change their perspectives on Madigan and Cullerton, as well as on the Republican side, too, on their legislative leaders, in terms of the possibility that maybe there is an opening, maybe that even a slightly wounded Madigan causes some concern for rank and file members in terms of his ability to protect them because of the five seats net four that they did lose?
The loss of John Bradley, I think, is very significant. He's a Southern Illinois Democrat. He's one of the lieutenants within the Madigan organization in the House, and him losing to Dave Severin, I think, speaks volumes. And that message is being heard by other Democrats. I talked with Democratic State Representative Elaine Nekritz, who did downplay a little bit of the possible power shift here. That we could see in as much as eating away at the Democrats' supermajority. But she still said she heard loud and clear voters saying that they want a balanced budget and that message was sent Tuesday with some seats flipping from blue to red in an election year.
Greg, do you think this puts pressure on Madigan to make some policy changes, put forward an honest, balanced budget? Or do you think that he digs his heels in and we get more of the same from the past 2 years?
That's tough to say because we've seen his message continuously downplaying the economic reforms that have been proposed, downplaying the political reforms that have been proposed, with the same message of it will hurt middle-class families. But I think that's starting to spoil, especially when you've got now the Illinois Manufacturers Association saying that the middle class is really being hurt by the status quo of not looking at these reforms as something to attract more jobs or at least to keep them here. So if he does continue that, I think people are going to see through it and maybe realize that with Illinois being at the bottom of all these economic indicators and businesses flying over the state, it's going to be difficult for him to continue that narrative.
He is Greg Bishop, reporter with the Illinois News Network and radio host. Bishop on Air on WMAY in Springfield. Greg, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We now return to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the radio show discussing the honest truth about Illinois policy and politics. Here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Michael Lucci, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Michael, some bad news. I mean, it's good news, bad news. It was nice for me personally to see Eric Holcomb win governor of Indiana to continue the policies of Mike Pence and a Mitch Daniels. But that means that Indiana will continue to be a more competitive environment to locate, say, manufacturing facilities than Illinois, such is the case in the rest of the Midwest as well. And just in the run-up to the election in October, Illinois hemorrhaged some more manufacturing companies.
That's right. We saw four companies that announced they are either closing up completely or moving new facilities across the border to whether it's Wisconsin. One of the companies announced it's going to be a southern state. They didn't say which one. But we're seeing this regularly, especially in northeast Illinois. We see people jumping the border to Indiana or Wisconsin. Wisconsin does not tax manufacturing income, so one more advantage that they have over Illinois for manufacturing businesses. It's a regular thing that happens. Last summer, we saw six companies move out all in the month of July, but there's this steady stream of companies that move out. The bigger issue that I think doesn't get as much headlines is nobody ever moves in. That's where you're really losing out on job opportunities because nobody ever moves in.
And just to name names, last month, October, Marisant, Kankakee-based manufacturing, employing 90 workers in Illinois, moving. Colbert Packaging in Lake Forest, moving 65 jobs plus another 45 new jobs to Kenosha. Altria, that was a big one. 300-job facility is shutting down in Franklin Park, relocating to another state. And Vonco Products in Lake Villa, also Lake County there, moving 86 people in its production about 10 miles north to Salem, Wisconsin. So to your point, those are some specific examples. And for more on this, we're pleased to be joined by a practitioner in the space who's got some real-world perspective on it. He's Al Popovich. He's head of a small manufacturer based in Custer Park, Illinois, Accurate Design and Fabrication. Al, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
So, Al, we're just mentioning the companies that have announced they're leaving Illinois in October. And as Michael Lucci was saying, that's just a continuing stream of manufacturers leaving Illinois for other states. You know, it's the old, we can't worry about competing with India. We can't even compete with Indiana. And so I wonder what your perspective is as a manufacturer on why these companies are leaving. And to Michael's point, why others are not coming in their place.
Well, from what I could see, is there's a lot of, for one, in Illinois, there's a lot of regulation, local, state, all that. But the costs here are just astronomical for, businesses don't mind costs. We don't mind spending money as long as we get a return. But with the insurance costs, the taxes, and everything else, we don't get anything back. And it's just you have to compete unless you have, we're fortunate we have a niche where we don't like it, but we can pay those close fees. But a lot of people that are competing with, other manufacturers and that, you can't absorb those costs.
I think that that's a great point that you're making. It's great if you have a niche and you can make it work in Illinois, but for a lot of companies, when you're manufacturing a product, that could perhaps be manufactured in another state or another country. And it's just simply unfair to an Illinois manufacturer to say, hey, go compete with those guys on the other side of the border, but we're going to throw all these taxes and regs on you. And they simply can't do it anymore. Al, what keeps you in the state? Is it the fact that you could survive with the niche that you work on, or is there something else that keeps you here?
Well, I've been here all my life, and I got family here and everything, and a lot of our clients are local, and because of the way our business is, that helps us a lot, because we have to be close to them. We have to be, you know, basically in a moment's notice, we have to be at your service. But yeah, when you're just making, you know, little widgets and the guy next door can make the same widget, you can't compete because there's, you know, it's just, you can't absorb all the cost that he doesn't have to.
Or
it has to come from somewhere.
or you know, like in you're saying, if you have to be responsive to a client base and your clients start moving, then, you know, a lot of time the first and second and third tier suppliers will move in unison with them.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, it would be the same way with us. I mean, if our clients moved, we would have to either, you know, move with them or try to find new ones. And in this state, that's pretty difficult. It's just not like it used to be where there was one on every corner.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt that, but one of the other things, you know, even if you're staying here because, like you say, of the need to service your clients, being close, physical proximity to them because you have family and just deep roots in Illinois, as is the case with a lot of businesses and a lot of families. But one of the other things is the kind of onerous climate you're describing in terms of regulation and taxation. Doesn't it inhibit you from thinking about expansion or thinking about hiring that next marginal employee or making that next investment into equipment?
Oh, definitely. You know, when people who aren't, you know, fully in the business or anything don't understand that, you know, all they basically see is when we hire someone is the hourly rate or whatever, but they don't understand all the other costs that we have to pay to hire an employee. And I would, you know, I think most small business owners are like me. They really, really appreciate their employees. You know, we have skilled people that I wouldn't be here without them. And I think they should be paid more. You know, I hear all about this raise the minimum wage. Well, my thought on that is raise the minimum skills, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd like to pay my people, and I think they're worth twice as much, but you just can't do it. When you go to, anytime you go to look at a machine or any type of expansion, the first thing you have to look at is, you know, how much is it going to cost me to, you know, pay all the taxes, regulations, and, you know, what's going to be regulated on a new machinery. It definitely makes it difficult.
Al, what would you like to see coming out of Springfield? We've had a couple years here where we've had governors saying we need to make changes. We've had a legislature who says we don't want to make any changes. What would you like to see coming out of Springfield that would make it easier for businesses like yours and others like it, to grow here, expand here, get investment here, just grow that base so that we could have more people getting jobs in this space?
Well, my thought on that always has been that a politician can never create a job, but if they get out of my way, I'll create them for them. And they just need to keep their hands out of it. It's, you know, there's some regulations that are definitely necessary, but it gets to the point where they use it as almost intimidation that, you know, the workman's comp is, they have to get it where it's fair, and that, you know, the fees for that doesn't have to be so much because it, you know, everybody wants, you know, if somebody does get hurt, everybody wants to see them getting taken care of, but it's gotten to the point where it's beyond that.
Is that when you talk to your colleagues, other people in the manufacturing space, is that the issue that most often comes up, the cost of work comp in Illinois?
I would say workman's comp and property taxes are probably the biggest gripes, and we sit down over a cup of coffee and discuss it. You know, it's and then, you know, the liability insurance and that we have to carry and all that, that's, you know, that's also an issue. The property taxes are a big one too.
Yeah, sure. Do you think your employees and people who aren't entrepreneurial capitalists like yourself, but people that and don't want to be, and that's fine, but people that work an honest 40 hour a week, do you think they get are more understanding of what's happening and the negative impacts of some of the policies we're talking about on you and thus by extension them? Do you think people are getting the dots connected better than maybe they have in the past, given the decline of Illinois?
I don't really think so. I think, you know, maybe a little more because, you know, we're starting to see it more in the news and stuff like that with you and people like yourselves trying to bring it to the front. So people understand, but I mean, for the longest time, I was that 40-hour employee. I didn't own a business all the time. And you just don't see it. I mean, you ask somebody about workman's comp insurance, they don't even understand
right. That
when you pay the government for the workman's comp, you really aren't insured for anything other than their pay if they're off. You know, they don't understand. I basically have two workman's comp insurance, one through the government and one through a private supplier. So there's a lot of details like that people don't understand. I think, you know, as small business owners, we try to explain it to them because, like I say, it's, you know, you fill a pitcher with iced tea, there's only so much in there, and it's, you know, the more glasses you have to fill, the less there is for each glass. So, like I say, I'd like to see my people make twice as much as what they do, but you just can't do it, you know?
Yeah. All right. He is Al Popovich. He is a manufacturer in Custer Park, Illinois. The business is Accurate Design and Fabrication. Al, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your perspectives. Appreciate it.
Dan, thank you very much for having me.
Dan Propt and Vice President of Policy at Illinois Policy Institute, Michael Lucci, joining me on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Michael, as usual, some interesting data collection and analysis by Illinois Policy Institute, your team over there. This about the labor force in Illinois synthesizing some Bureau of Labor Statistics data to give us a picture of how Illinois' labor force compares to our Great Lakes neighbors. And what's the bad news?
Well, the bad news is, once again, over the warm season of the year, Illinois' labor force shrank. So what's likely happening, and we've seen this in previous summers also, is summer's when people move. So when your labor force is shrinking every summer, and people tend to move in the summer, a lot of that is because people are moving to other states to go get a job in another state during the summer. I mean, that's when it's going to happen. So we've seen this happen for Illinois consistently. The labor force in Illinois has shrank more than it has in any other state around us for, you know, the past 8 years. But then we saw this sudden labor force dropout in this past summer. It's something that's been happening here, and it's economic reasons. People move for jobs.
And give us the numbers to give us some order of magnitude. Compare Illinois to, you know, Michigan, Missouri, Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, our neighbors.
Illinois' workforce shrank by 104,000 people over the summer, whereas, you know, Ohio was down about 70,000, Michigan 55,000. Iowa and Indiana actually had their workforces grow over the summer, and a state like Kentucky was more or less even over the season. But we see Illinois, once again, having the most shrinking of the workforce, while other states aren't even having that same effect, and states that do have workforce dropout don't have it nearly so bad.
I mean, that's huge. So April to September, so you're talking about 5 months this past summer, 104,000 loss in Illinois, 14,000 gain in our neighbor to the east, Indiana. That's a startling number, isn't it?
And some of that's just a transfer. Some of that is a transfer of Illinois workers to Indiana.
Right.
So that's part of what's happening. It's scary that Illinois has a long-term problem of the workforce shrinking because that shouldn't be happening. The population is still growing, but you're having the workforce shrinking. You're just having a smaller portion of the Illinois population actually working because a lot of people who want to work find that they have to go to another state to do it. And especially we find young folks are moving out, whether it's young taxpayers or young students. When you look at data from the IRS, taxpayers are moving out, especially young taxpayers. And we look at data from the Department of Education. Students are moving out to go to university in other states.
And what happens when students leave to go to a college in another state? Oftentimes they don't come back, and they're not coming back to a state that doesn't have job opportunities in their chosen field of endeavor. And if you've got a labor force shrinking, that would seem to indicate that maybe there's not going to be a lot of job opportunities in a whole lot of fields of endeavor.
That's exactly right. And so we're seeing students dropping out of the state. We're seeing millennials dropping out of the state, working millennials dropping out of the state. They're going to find their future in a place that is more hospitable to job creation. And this is especially the case in some of the Rust Belt communities in Illinois. If you're a manufacturer, and we speak with manufacturers on this show, if you're a manufacturing worker and you want to find that job opportunity, most likely it's going to be in a Wisconsin or an Indiana, and you're going to have to make that move to go get that job.
I want to underscore millennials and young families because a couple weeks ago on this show, we talked to an analyst from the Granite Institute that had did some study of population inflows and outflows. And one of the things about Illinois, people leave because they want to retire to Florida, Arizona because of the cold winters. That's why people are leaving. And it's mostly seniors. And if you actually look at the data, according to this Granite Institute study that was done in conjunction with Illinois policy, no, it's not. It's young families, 35 to 54, that are working their way up the ladder in whatever sector they're in and who don't see the next rung for them in Illinois, and millennials. So it's the people that are entering the workforce and in their prime working years that are actually leading the exodus, and that really spells trouble.
Those are your taxpayers. Those are the people you need to try to fix this long-term debt liability that the state, that the cities have built up. Without those young taxpayers sticking around or even better moving in, the question is who's going to pay for those debts and for those liabilities. There's just not going to be enough people around to do that. And that's the problem that Illinois is facing right now. This problem is I think, coming home even now. We're seeing that tax revenues are declining year over year in Illinois. And that happens when you have so many taxpayers move out and you have such poor job creation locally. So we're seeing this in the first couple months of the new year here, the new fiscal years, that Illinois' tax revenues are lower this year than they were last year with the same tax rates, everything being the same. It's because so many people are leaving.
And it makes the sense of urgency we should have about structural reform of state government that much more pressing, doesn't it?
Completely pressing. I mean, you can't solve a revenue problem by driving taxpayers out of the state. You can't solve a spending problem by hiking taxes on the people who are staying, giving them even more reason to move out of the state.
Dan Prof, back with Michael Lucci, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute. And Mike, it looks like I'm going to have to go to Northwest Indiana to buy my grape crush in bulk if I don't want to get hit in the pocketbook again by Cook County government. What's going on there?
Cook County is once again trying to fix a spending problem by raising new tax revenues, and this time they're trying to do it by putting a tax on soda or any other types of sugary drinks. The interesting thing here, as with many taxes in Illinois, is this one is specifically targeted at lower-income people. And this is a normal outcome when you have large and growing government. There are fewer and fewer things to tax, and so you end up taxing things that are consumed more by lower-income people. It becomes what's called a regressive tax system. That's the consequence of having large government. You just have these regressive results where poor people have a harder time to get along here.
And so this soda tax, we call it pop, by the way. I don't know why they keep calling it a soda tax. It's called pop in Chicago. You want to go to the South, then you can call it soda. Here, you call it pop. It's just more. This is the vocabulary of our enemies we're adopting. So no more soda. It's pop here. But give us the details on this pop tax that Preckwinkle and Little Lord Fauntleroy Bloomberg from New York City have conspired to impose, and then some specifics about, just the nature of the regressivity of it and who it impacts the most.
So they want to put a penny per ounce tax on pop. So if you're thinking about a can, which is 12 ounces, there's going to be 12 cents tax added to a can of Coke or whatever your drink is. And as it turns out, according to Gallup polling, the folks who consume more of this tend to have lower incomes. For example, 45% of people with incomes below $30,000 drink, these sugary drinks. A third of people with incomes from $30,000 to $75,000 drink sugary drinks or pop. And then only one-fifth of people with income above $75,000 actually drink pop. So this tax is, they know that this is going to go after people with lower incomes, and they simply don't care.
Yeah, as long as they don't put a tax on a sugary drink called bourbon, then I'll be pretty happy with that. But here's the thing. The other thing that happens, two things, right? One, there's elasticity of demand. And so people will go to neighboring counties or in Illinois, neighboring states, to buy these goods that are overtaxed in Cook County. We've seen that with, for example, the cigarette taxes.
Right. I actually used to work in an area of Chicago where there would be someone selling individual cigarettes, and he would be selling them at the price per cigarette that a pack of cigarettes would be. So if cigarettes are $10 a pack here, that breaks down to 50 cents a cigarette. and there would be someone on the corner every day selling individual cigarettes for 50 cents each. And I would always wonder, how's he making money on this? He's buying them for 50 cents each, selling them for 50 cents each. That's not the case. He was buying them for probably 30 cents each in Indiana,
right,
bringing them across the border and then selling them individually on a corner in Chicago.
I mean, that's incredible. Chicago's economy is driven by arbitraging our tax system with respect to, you know, neighboring counties and neighboring states. And the other thing about this is, like the tobacco tax, one, it won't realize the revenue they project because they analyze things statically, does the government. And so they project a much bigger number than it actually turns out because people respond to the incentives they're presented with and they will do what we're just describing. The other thing is, this is one of those taxes where the government comes in and says, we're taxing you because this is bad for you, so don't do it. Except at the same time, they're counting on you to do it because they have already budgeted for and spent the revenue they expect to realize. So it's predatory government.
Right. So if you actually stop doing this, if you do what the government says they want, which is stop drinking your Coca-Cola, then they're going to have to find some new way to tax you. They're going to have to come back and maybe they're going to tax hamburgers next or whatever it's going to be, whatever they think they can sell as being good for your health. But it's a silly way to govern, like chasing people around, taxing this thing that they do because we think it's a sin, then taxing the next thing, then taxing the other thing. The problem here is they keep spending more money at the county level and they don't want to fix that. The salaries for county workers keep going up and they don't want to fix that. Meanwhile, the salaries of private sector workers are stagnating, even going down. Job opportunities are going down, yet they keep taxing these people who have fewer and fewer opportunities in the private economy in order to keep spending money on the government side of it.
Right. So the ruling class in Cook County and Chicago, just understand this, folks, they want you to drink pop all the time. Drink more pop. They want you to smoke cigarettes. They want you to blow through red lights because they've budgeted for and spent the money they expect to realize from being predatory with respect to your habits in these areas. That's number one. And then number two, so much political capital is spent and time is spent focused on these things with respect to the structural deficits and debt that Cook County, the city of Chicago, the state of Illinois face. These things are driplets in the bucket in terms of the revenue they expect to generate. Driplets. This will pay for a couple of Cook County workers making $100,000 in their pensions, this sugar drink tax, right?
That's right. And it was interesting that the other proposals that are coming along in this Cook County budget is, one, to give the Cook County council members a couple $100,000 each to spend on local projects. That's a new proposal to help them go along with this tax. So not only are we going to put this tax towards spending that's not necessarily needed at the county level, we're going to spike it by saying, and we're going to give the council members slush funds that they could spend in their areas to help curry political favor with people who might not like the idea of this tax. So what they never really ask is, where can we cut? Because that's what's needed. You can't just keep taxing Chicagoans, Cook County people, and then the state of Illinois in general. People are moving out. People are moving out of Cook, out of Chicago, out of the state. It's a losing strategy. You can't keep doing it. They're going to need to turn around and say, how do we restructure government so it's affordable for our taxpayers?
But those slush funds will be nice for next year if the aldermen and members of the Cook County Board need to buy their Cubs World Series tickets off StubHub rather than at face value. Dan Prof back with Michael Lucci, Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Michael, one of the really central stories of this recently passed election cycle is WikiLeaks and hacked emails and the discovery of a private homebrew server on the dearly departed Hillary Clinton. And one of the things we found from WikiLeaks is that she is not the only public official going private with respect to official communications related to her public post. Tiny Dancer has romemail.com domain. And, you know, this goes to the Chicago Tribune's pursuit of Rom's communications, whether it's texts or emails. They said, well, here's all the public stuff. No. We want the private stuff, too, where you're trying to avoid FOIA laws, Freedom of Information Act requests, disclosure requirements, because you're using a private email or a private phone to conduct public business. And those should be retrievable and available for public scrutiny as well. The romemail.com domain, how should we understand that?
Well, we should understand in the context of Chicago, because the other report that came out is that 19 aldermen also do the same thing. So in Chicago, these guys just think that rules, ethics, the law doesn't apply to them. We saw that with the Chicago Cubs tickets. We're seeing that with email. But I think it's an important issue in Chicago because there's a very dangerous thing that could be happening. And it surprised me if it isn't happening, is when favors are traded between the mayor and perhaps a developer, or alderman and a developer, and this is all recorded on private email rather than public email, taxpayers don't realize what's happening, which is, you know, a certain zoning change is being made on some sort of agreement that's behind closed door. These things should be on public record so that taxpayers understand why certain changes are being made in the city, why certain people are getting favors, because that's what Chicago's government runs on, is using the law and using changes in the law to enrich people who are politically connected.
Yeah, I know. These guys love cameras so much. I would love to live stream with audio all the business that goes on the fifth floor of City Hall, where Tiny Dancer has his tiny office. And I wonder, too, boy, the contents of these emails. You think the those that were on the Podesta email chain were revealed to be venal, petty, preteens when it came to so much important public policy discussion? Could you imagine the profane and kind of lobotomized content we would find on Rom's email chains with all of these goons that are associated with this administration, with, as you say, interacting with the 50 trained SEALs on the city council? This would be great reading for the city of Chicago if you really understand how the city that works, wouldn't it?
This is what needs to be made public, is what's actually happening that is behind the operation of city government. Why do people get certain favors and other people, who just say a small business with no connections, has to go through every, you know, monthly inspections, all sorts of red tape just to get his business off the ground, but certain people are able to get going quickly because they're politically connected? This is very unusual. The former legislative inspector general who researched this issue for the city council, Faisal Khan, he came out of New York where he said this stuff would not be allowed at all.
It should all be discoverable under FOIA, right? This all should have to be disclosed under FOIA. That's the argument the Tribune is making in court.
Right. That's the argument they're making. And one of the problems is, with so many people operating off the grid of the public emails, nobody really knows what might be where. You don't even know what you're looking for. If some alderman's conducting all of his business on a private server and you don't even know about that, you don't know what to FOIA. So one of the problems with finding this out is, if these guys are all doing business offline, through their digital communications offline, you don't even know what to look for. Now, obviously, that the mayor's doing it, and that should be FOIAble. And the city council members are doing it also. That should be FOIAble. So we'll see if there's some email scrubbing that these guys do, like the secretary.
Yeah, did. A little borrow her bleach bit. Well, I'll tell you what, if they don't disclose, if they don't turn over, maybe somebody can wake Zach Farden up over at 219 South Dearborn, and he can get involved.